Hello and welcome to the World Soccer Talk podcast, your weekly dose of talking about watching soccer on TV, online and apps. Coming up on episode 43, we debate whether soccer is a niche sport in the United States or not, as well as updating you on the end of an era at Fox Soccer after two top executives leave the company. And we discuss which European league wants to play regular season games in the United States. Plus, we have a ton of letters from you, listeners, in our mailbag section. My name is Christopher Harris, a.k.a. The Gaffer, and I'm joined by Kartik Krishnaya. Kartik, both you and I are... We survived Hurricane Irma. What an ordeal that was. I ended up evacuating and went to Tennessee just to get away from the storm for about a week, and had no power in Florida for about 5 to 6 days, so I was glad I got away. What about you? How did the storm end, or the hurricane end up for you?
Well, it was a lot worse than it should have been. The area you and I live in got, according to the National Weather Service, got Category 1 force winds and Category 2 force gusts. But it still absolutely ravaged this area. 90% of the people were left without power, myself included, you included. Obviously, you weren't in town, but there was no point in you returning when you didn't have power. And tree limbs down, not as much structural damage as is possible in a hurricane. But again, we only had Cat 1 winds in the southeastern Florida area. And just general havoc around town, and trees down, lots of uprooted trees, just general. I can't even describe the adjective, but there is a sense that we got hit by a freight train, yeah. And there's very little kind of lingering ability to get back to normal. I think this is going to linger with us in Southeast Florida for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as it relates to soccer, I mean, a lot of soccer in terms of postponements, whether it's games in Texas this week, the Copa MX games, or MX games in Mexico, all of those were canceled. And then Florida hit by the weather and a lot of kind of last-minute schedule changes right before Hurricane Irma to try to get squeeze matches in before these before the hurricane hit.
So, yeah, and several delays at NASL, Miami FC's last two games have been postponed. Tampa Bay had a road trip cut short where USL rightly postponed their game away in Bethlehem and let them come back, the players come back to be part of to be with their families during the storm. Jacksonville Armada, I believe, had two games postponed. So it's been tough. The thing that, and I'm going to use this forum to point it out, the thing I just still do not understand, cannot justify, is Major League Soccer having Orlando City play a game, which they ended up winning, and it's only their third win in the last 3.5 months. But a game at RFK Stadium against DC United when their area was under a hurricane warning and the airport in Orlando was already shut down because of high winds. They played that away game. So they didn't spend the time with their family. They didn't come back. There was no way for them to return to Orlando after the game for several days. Yet they played the game very nonchalantly. MLS made no mention of the hurricane, whereas USL had brought the Rowdies, who were also playing an away game that same night, home, made an early decision to postpone it on Wednesday. So the Rowdies were able to cut their road trip short and come back to the Tampa Bay area. NWSL moved up the Orlando Pride game to a Thursday night, so they got that out of the way, and they got the Seattle Rain out of town before the storm came and before the airport closed. And as I said, NASL canceled two Miami FC games and two Jacksonville Armada games. So to me, it's just a stunner. MLS and they did cancel a Houston game during Harvey, so it's not that they're unaware of the weather, but I was just stunned by it.
As we can see, I mean, whether it's hurricanes or earthquakes, they definitely have an impact on soccer, and so they should. In regards to soccer, of course, last week we had no podcast because of both Kartik and I were without power, and also running around trying to get shutters up and just trying to get everything ready for the approaching storm and hurricane. And then this week for this podcast, for the past week or so, or the last couple of weeks, I think both you, Kartik, and I haven't watched as much soccer as we normally would, just because, like I said, we've been taking care of our families and businesses and just making sure that everyone was safe and neighbors, etc. So, but one thing, Kartik, and of course, for each show that we do, We don't talk about it beforehand, so both you and I are going cold into this. But from the last week or so of watching soccer, and of course I was able to watch quite a few games in Tennessee, but what I did find out, Kartik, was, at least for me personally, was that there haven't been a lot of exciting games. We've seen a lot of kind of blowouts. I mean, a lot of blowouts, whether it's in the League Cup or the Premier League, or a lot of very parking-the-bus type of games where it's extremely negative and just teams holding on defensively to try to get, I mean, a point. I haven't personally seen any really exciting games that I can say, like, wow, that was a great game. I really enjoyed that exciting, open-ended game of soccer. Wasn't that fantastic? And what about you, Kartik? Did you see anything in the last couple of weeks that that really stood out?
No, not really. I think we're seeing a situation, as you mentioned, where you've got greater imbalances, or kind of implied, within these European leagues. And teams are either parking the bus and trying to score on the counter, or there are teams like Manchester City and Dortmund, although Dortmund concedes a lot of goals. There are teams that are just playing other teams off the pitch. But I watched Dortmund against Cologne the other day, and it wasn't even a contest. Yeah. So there just seems to be a growing imbalance in a lot of these European leagues. And even I know you watched Spurs Swansea, and I'm probably happy with the result. But again, that was a one-way traffic, and it was Swansea well-organized, hanging on for a result. But there was no contest there, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. For me, I mean, I'm probably one of the very few, but to me, that was Swansea's performance in that match was a masterclass in playing a 3-5-2 and just trying to park the bus and prevent Spurs from creating too many chances and just trying to claw away for a draw, and if lucky, on a counterattack, a win. And actually, towards the end of the game, last 5 to 10 minutes of the game, it looked like they might get a goal. But for the neutrals, or for the fans of other teams, that must have been an incredibly boring match, as was the Swansea-Newcastle game too, which is Swansea's playing very conservatively. They're a much different team now than they were under Brendan Rodgers or Gary Monk. This is definitely a very pragmatic Swansea.
The thing that I would also note about that game, which to me is interesting, is tactically, you had Pochettino not have any pretense that he would have to defend, and he put he stuffed another attacker in putting Son in as a left wing back instead of Davies, another attacking player, a guy who had double digit goals in the Premier League last year, because he figured that Swansea wasn't going to attack and that he would use those wing back positions, or one of those wing back positions, to fit another attacker into his team. And I wonder if that will be a growing tactical trend as teams park the bus. Since more and more teams are playing with three at the back, do you use those wing-back positions to, maybe this is something Liverpool does because they have so much trouble against bunker teams. Maybe now that they've signed Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, they do play him at right wing-back in those sorts of games.
Yeah, it makes sense in terms of a competing tactic that to kind of break down that wall of sometimes you've got 10 defenders essentially behind the ball. The one game I did watch, Kartik, that I did enjoy watching in terms of, at least it was very competitive, and that was Chelsea against Arsenal. I thought the level of football was great. It was really one of those games where Arsenal lifted up their performance to a level that really competed well against Chelsea. And to me, that was an example of a highly entertaining 0-0 game. Because, I mean, a lot of soccer critics say, like, 0-0, how boring could that be? This was an example of a really entertaining game. Unfortunately, no goal in this one. But Peter Drury in this one, Kartik, I don't know if you caught this one, was that when Arsenal did score the goal, which was later disallowed, Peter Drury, like, screaming, proclaiming, "Arsenal, take the lead at the bridge." And it was so kind of emphatic, so kind of like, oh my gosh, did you just see that? This is history in the making. Look at this. And then the whistle blew to disallow the goal. A little bit of egg on the face of Peter Drury, but it is what it is, I guess.
Yeah, I think this is also kind of interesting because there's been so much panic among the Arsenal fans during the first few weeks of the season, summer of discontent again among fans at the Emirates. But this is a very credible result. And while every match does matter in the Premier League, I know critics of Major League Soccer like to say that nothing matters until right before the playoffs, and every game in the Premier League matters. With Arsenal, it doesn't really, because we see this, we generally see this every season. Arsenal starts slowly out of the gates, and they find a way into the top four. Now, it didn't happen last season, and last season, the first match of the season did matter, because they lost to Liverpool at the Emirates, and Liverpool ended up piping them by a point or two for fourth. But I tell you, I think that there was probably a little too much panic in the media everywhere about Arsenal. This is a very, very credible result. It's still September, and generally they don't get these sorts of results early in the season.
Absolutely. Yeah. To me, it's Arsenal. It's just a typical roller coaster, kind of a seesaw. I mean, it's the fans go crazy and the public and everyone on social media go like, Wenger out. And then the next game they come along and put in a really good performance. Now, the next performance after that probably is going to be a weak one. But we've been through this so many times that people do kind of over-exaggerate. And I think NBC Sports, to a degree, too, in terms of that. It was a demoralizing defeat from Arsenal, a few weeks ago. But they really went in big time, kind of with knives almost, into Arsenal's performance that match, which was poor. But as we've seen, they bounced back from that and they'll go down again, and then they'll bounce back again. It's the same old story.
The other thing to remember about this is that Chelsea now has winless in their last three against Arsenal, won four of the five under Antonio Conte. Chelsea's great record-breaking Premier League season last season, when they won the title, was largely on the backs of how they performed against the other sides in the league below the top six. So they dropped points last season to Arsenal. They dropped points to Liverpool. They dropped points to Man United. But they dropped points to Tottenham. But they had 95 points or whatever at the end of the season. So they are 93 points, whatever it was. I think that this will disappoint Antonio Conte, but they, other than that one-off against Burnley, have shown over the last two seasons they generally don't drop points to lesser sides.
And then we had Atlanta against Orlando, Kartik, that was on Saturday on Univision Deportes. For those listeners who don't know, this was a MLS record attendance. It broke the record at over 70,000 people. But what was the television product like in terms of kind of that experience from what you saw, Kartik?
Yeah, I DVR'd the game because I taken a trip out to the west coast of Florida to check out hurricane damage from Irma. And unfortunately, I didn't turn my phone off for alerts, so I knew the score when I got back. The television experience was really good on Univision. I think they do a better job than Fox of capturing the ambiance and the atmosphere at games, and we've talked about this before, obviously with regards to Fox and how they cover various soccer events and how the crowd is drowned out, it seems. Univision did an outstanding job. The game was very entertaining. It was Atlanta United, who is an entertaining team. For those of you who don't watch Major League Soccer, they're a team that plays a very slick brand of football. They're able to keep the ball and pass well. They're also able to counterattack, which they did pretty well in this game, although defensively they weren't able to handle Orlando's aerial game with Dom Dwyer and Kyle Larin, which was a good thing for Orlando, because Orlando's had a very poor season.
Right.
Another aspect of this game that was interesting was that we have a situation where I think Orlando fans, and I know a lot of them listen to this podcast, have a developing, or maybe it's a fully developed, envy and jealousy now of Atlanta, and it's their closest rival in MLS also. Orlando built their team the proper way, if you will, in the lower leagues, worked their way up from USL to Major League Soccer. They were the ones setting attendance records until this year when Atlanta came to the league. Atlanta kind of appeared out of thin air. They're not a former lower division club. The Silverbacks were the lower division club in NASL in Atlanta, and they have a good team. They have the team with the fourth best record in the league, in the entire league, 22 team league, in their first season. And Orlando will, it appears, miss the playoffs for the third successive year. So there's a budding rivalry there that added to the ambiance. A lot of traveling Orlando fans, many of them probably traveling still without power after the hurricane, much like you getting out of town, right? Mm-hmm. Driving a little bit north. And it added to the atmosphere of the game. So I quite enjoyed it. Now, the only issue I have is that it's an indoor stadium with field turf, and that kind of minimizes the experience, I have to say. And I think this is my reaction to most indoor stadiums, to be honest with you, even if there's grass. And if it's turf, it makes it worse.
For me, yeah, Kartik, I had the opposite kind of opinion in terms of what you saw in terms of this match. I was really, yes, the crowd was fantastic, incredible crowd, but I was really turned off, first of all, by the field turf. I mean, it's an AstroTurf pitch, so the ball, the bounce, I mean, it's not as bad as some of the pitches in the, well, the 70s or 80s NESL days, but that I was turned off by. But the other thing I didn't like was just the way that this match was televised. I mean, it's not Univision's fault, but you could not see the massive crowds. It was the way that the camera angles were set up. I guess it's set up for NFL football, but it didn't give you kind of the viewpoint in terms of seeing just how full the stands were. You kind of just saw maybe, I don't know, the bottom 10 rows or something like that, and you missed kind of the big walls on the side. So I thought from a television perspective, I was disappointed. I watched about 10 minutes of the match, and to be honest with you, with the field turf, I just completely got turned off and switched channels. I did see Josef Martinez's goal, the header, which was fantastic, brilliant goal, but I just can't watch soccer this way. It just feels inauthentic and completely turned me off. And it feels like it's filled. And it was a strange thing, too, because it was a 4 o'clock kickoff on a Saturday. But the way, I don't know if the roof was open or not, but the lighting, it just felt like it could have been at 10 o'clock at night, or it could have been, you didn't have that natural light coming into the pitch. I don't know, it just felt like I was watching something plastic. That's my thoughts, Kartik. So let's move on to some of the other games.
I'll point out one thing real quickly about that. That's my kind of takeaway from the Atlanta experience, and it's odd because Major League Soccer, Don Garber himself said part of the reason why they opted to elevate the NASL team from Minnesota United, versus going with the Minnesota Vikings bid for an MLS team, and obviously Minnesota's entered Major League Soccer the same year as Atlanta, was that Minnesota United, an established NASL brand, a team that traces its lineage actually back further than any MLS team, back to the early 90s, was building an outdoor stadium. And that was important to Major League Soccer. But for some reason in Atlanta, it wasn't important. So that still confuses me. I think there are inconsistencies in what they want and in which markets. I'm glad they've done the right thing in Minnesota, by the way. But I can't argue with you on that point.
Yeah, the strange thing is, I mean, the Bobby Dodd Stadium, to me, wasn't made for soccer, but was a better experience than watching, from a television perspective, games there than it is in this beautiful stadium, which looks like state-of-the-art, looks incredible. And I'm sure if you're at the match and you're in that stadium, it's probably a brilliant experience, but just watching it on television just feels, I don't know, it just feels cheap. It just does not feel right. It does not feel natural, because it should be a natural grass. I mean, with the stadium, I don't know. Anyway, let's move on, Kartik. So what are some of the other things you watched this past week that you want to highlight?
Yeah, so I watched the League Cup, going kind of out of order here, the League Cup, and I had some trouble with my internet during that, and I don't know if it's my internet, although some other people complained. The ESPN3 stream is either perfect or it stalls for a few seconds and jumps ahead. And that happened to me many times on Tuesday. I finally gave up. On Wednesday, I didn't give up because it was a Manchester City game, but I ended up missing Leroy Sané's game winner. Because of that, and it's frustrating, because I'll say that when last year in the same competition, when I was using the Go90 app for the games and for using BN Sports Go90 app, there were none of these problems. Now, it could be that my internet has slowed down post Irma. I know this is a common problem in throughout the state of Florida, where there are people like our friend Neil Blackman doesn't have internet at all right now, mm-hmm. and his Wi-Fi is not working, even though he finally got power back. So there are internet problems. What will be important for me to see is if it happens in this set of championship games coming up, and then the next round of the League Cup. If that's the case, then it may be a bandwidth issue with ESPN3.
Yeah, I watched most of the games. Well, on the Tuesday, I watched the Reading-Swansea game. I did hop around a little bit just to see what was going on in the other matches. I didn't experience any issues on Tuesday. Wednesday, same thing too, just no problems for me on my side. And again, it could be internet connection-wise, or it could be just that particular stream, let me say, for the West Brom-Man City game might have had a lot more viewers and may have had some technical issues, but I didn't see any from my side. What I would say to Kartik is that seven League Cup games on ESPN3 midweek, to me, that's better than what beIN Sports was offering last season. Of course, with beIN Sports, I mean, probably one or two of those games would have been on television. We don't get that yet with the ESPN3s. But overall, in terms of quantity, we got that. The quality was lacking, I think, not from the production value, but just in terms of the matches themselves. Most of them were very one-sided, and actually on the Wednesday's matches, I think in the first like 10 or 15 minutes, most of the Uniteds, the Cities, had already scored goals, so I ended up switching over, I think, to Hamburg against Dortmund to watch that match, the second half of that one, and that ended up beIN a really one-sided game too, so... I was looking for a really entertaining game. I could not find one. And that's what I've been doing, kind of struggling with the last couple of weeks, is trying to find some really entertaining two-sided football matches where you never know who's going to win, open-ended, and we're not seeing a lot of that. I would say that for the Hamburg-Dortmund game, it was interesting. Actually, it was positive to see Alexi Lalas in the studio for the studio coverage there with Ronaldo and Ian Joy. And Lalas seemingly interested in the Bundesliga in a studio analysis, did a good job and didn't seem as bored or monotone as he is sometimes when he's calling some of the Premier League matches competing in the Europa League. So that was good to see. And actually it was a good broadcast from Fox in terms of the Bundesliga. Anything else, Kartik, that you've been watching the last couple of weeks you want to point out?
No, not really. I mean, as you mentioned at the outset, we haven't watched as much football. That Dortmund-Cologne game I did watch. I guess I should mention real quickly U.S. Open Cup final with John Champion and Taylor Twellman. Great atmosphere at Children's Mercy Park. And another U.S. Open triumph for Kansas City. That's their fourth. New York Red Bull still, other than Supporters Shield's trophyless. So that was a good game. And tried to watch the previous game, the Atlanta-LA Galaxy game that was on ESPN. They had a doubleheader. That was a waste of time. Atlanta ripped them open. And it was so bad that with this ongoing litigation that the NASL's filed against the U.S. Soccer Federation, Nipun, our former co-host on the show, Neil Blackman, the aforementioned Neil Blackman, and I decided just to rip out a podcast in the second half. We knew we wanted to do one, and that was the most opportune time because that game was had become unwatchable.
Yeah, I watched. I actually watched about 5 minutes of the match. I think tuned in right at halftime, so it was 4-0. And then watched maybe like the last 5 minutes of the Atlanta LA Galaxy game, where Atlanta was really just passing the ball back and forward as if it was a preseason friendly, and LA Galaxy kind of sitting back, not even trying to get the ball. It seemed a big turn off, and even I think it was Alejandro Moreno and Adrian Healy seemed really bored too, not really saying much, just a waste of a match there. Did Kartik, did you catch it at all? I mean, did ESPN2 with the broadcast of the U.S. Open Cup final, did they go into the NASL antitrust lawsuit at all? Or ESPN FC, did they talk about it this week?
I'm backed up on my ESPN FC ESPN FC viewing, so I don't know yet. I have Tuesday and Wednesday on DVR. Okay. As far as this U.S. Open Cup final, no, I don't remember it being mentioned or during the Atlanta-LA Galaxy game. So that's that was Adrian Healy and Alejandro Moreno. I don't remember any mention of it. That having been said, ESPN FC has talked about it on their website, so it's not like they're skirting it completely. I just don't know that they've discussed it on the show program as of yet.
Okay. All right. So, Kartik, let's move on to TV streaming news.
Yeah. As we alluded to at the outset of the podcast, it's been almost 2 weeks now since David Nathanson stepped down or has left Fox Sports. And he has been with the network for for years, and was really instrumental in their soccer coverage, not just in acquiring the World Cup rights for 2018, 2022, and 26, but he did a lot of work with Fox Soccer Channel. He was a key player in pushing soccer as a big agenda item for FS1 and FS2 when it launched, and he'd been with Fox since 1999 and had managed Fox Sports World back in the day. Remember that, and Fox Soccer Channel. So a big loss for the soccer world, and one thing that had struck everybody when FS1 and FS2 launched, and they did all their launch events, publications like Sports Business Journal and the Wall Street Journal, was how much Fox executives, and particularly David Nathanson, talked about soccer's importance in the role in the launches of those networks. And so that's unfortunate, I think, for soccer's presence on Fox. Also leaving Fox is Jaunty Whitehead, who was responsible for Fox's production of a lot of their Champions League coverage, FA Cup, and Europa League.
Yeah, the timing of this is a little bit strange. I mean, you've got one of the top guys at Fox Sports who's been managing the soccer side of the business from back in the Fox Soccer Channel days, like you said, Kartik, and then also the top producer, executive producer, who's been doing a lot of the Champions League and FA Cup and Europa League. So the timing of him leaving Jaunty Whitehead and taking a consultancy role is a bit strange, especially with a lot of these rights coming up. I mean, they lost the Champions League, but I guess both of them probably think in their heads that they can probably go on to bigger and better things, and maybe this is an opportunity for them to move ahead. But we'll have to wait and see how this impacts Fox Sports' coverage of the of soccer in general, whether it's going to help it or hurt it. Jaunty Whitehead, in an interview he did with Alexi Lalas about a year ago, was really, really dismissive of U.S. soccer fans in general, just kind of saying that he purposely dumbed down the coverage to appeal to U.S. soccer fans, and wasn't as kind of in-depth as he would have been when he worked at Sky in the U.K. So that's... It will be interesting to see if that changes. If it, I don't know. At the end of the day, I think Fox will be the same. I don't think there's going to be any big changes. But yeah, behind the scenes, there is an opportunity here for new people with new ideas to step in and maybe do things a little bit differently and maybe perhaps a little bit better. We'll have to wait and see what happens there. Kartik, in other news, La Liga has announced plans that they would like to go ahead and play regular season games overseas. Now, their president, Javier Tebas, says that the 20 La Liga clubs have discussed the possibility of playing matches overseas, possibly in the United States, possibly in China, as part of their regular season schedule. And La Liga would have to get approval from UEFA and FIFA to make this happen. There was an article, actually, I think about a week ago, from Bobby McMahon on Forbes. And he said that La Liga is really kind of thinking of too big in terms of what they think that La Liga is all about, because other than Barcelona and Real Madrid and Atleti and maybe Sevilla, really, who's going to watch Eibar against Las Palmas? So who's going to get excited about watching some of the other teams from La Liga? It's really about Real Madrid and really about Barcelona, and those are just two teams out of 20. What are you going to do about the other 16 teams that are not going to be as big as those? So that one maybe is just a lot of talk from La Liga, but perhaps maybe... I mean, out of all the leagues in Europe, La Liga has been the most aggressive in trying to change everything, change the format, change the kickoff times, and really try to go global. So you never know. It's but big plans here from La Liga. Kartik, what about some other news?
Yeah, so Sky has signed a deal with the Football League for the UK rights to the Championship, League One, League Two, and the League Cup, of course, from 2019 to 2024. The $800 million in U.S. dollars TV deal is a 36% increase in fees from the present agreement. Under the new deal, this is important because there are a lot of midweek fixture dates in the Football League. Sky will be able to stream all midweek championship games, which It's the first time in the UK for a deal like this, and that's a great deal for fans, because typically those games kick off at 7:45 or 8 o'clock local time, and there has been complaints by fans that it's a weeknight, they can't get to the grounds, they can't travel the way they normally would, and they don't get to see the matches. So that's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, and it could have an impact in the U.S. I mean, right now, ESPN3 is streaming usually maybe midweek games, maybe one or two. So a lot of that is because the other games aren't available. So in 2019, if ESPN still has the deal through BAMTech, there's a possibility that they might be able to show more of those games to the U.S. The other complication, though, too, is that iFollow, which is the streaming service from the clubs in the Football League, they stream, I mean, all of the games, almost all of the games, worldwide outside of the UK and Ireland. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there, because, I mean, you've got people paying subscription fees to see those games. And now if more games are going to be available, does that decrease the number of iFollow subscribers as people then continue to watch it on ESPN3. But we're still a ways off from knowing exactly if ESPN3 and BAMTech would even have the rights at that stage and how that would impact. So, something to keep an eye out for. Kartik, so Netflix and Amazon have reportedly approached Chelsea, Manchester City, and Liverpool about a plan to broadcast behind-the-scenes documentaries of these clubs. It's being seen as a way for both Netflix and Amazon to delve into the UK sports market, according to the Daily Mirror. Now, we saw a few years ago, maybe even 4 or 5 years ago now, Being Liverpool, which was meant to be part of a whole series that Fox Sports launched. They wanted to do Being Arsenal, Being Manchester United. But they launched Being Liverpool, which was a documentary series behind the kind of a fly on the wall, which is like, I don't know, like a four-part or five-part series. And it was shot and filmed and released in the UK and the US. And for the most part, it was kind of, it was mixed reviews. I thought it was actually, at the time, the only things I actually remember from it, just a few scenes, and that was the Brendan Rodgers envelope trick that he did with the players in the hotel. And then there was the Raheem Sterling, where Brendan Rodgers told him off in a training session for not listening or not paying attention. And then I remember kind of the poet talking about Liverpool and what it meant to live in the streets of Liverpool and things like that. But the rest of it's kind of a blur. I don't really remember too much of it. But what do you think, Kartik? Do you think this could be a good idea, or is this something that could be along the lines of Being Liverpool?
No, I think it could be a very good idea. And actually, Fox, had they not lost the Premier League rights, were exploring doing a Being Man City and Being Chelsea. So it's the same clubs that 5 years ago now, because that was 2012, early in the 2012-13 season when those Being Liverpool specials aired, would be similar clubs. And I think it's a good idea. Although I have to say, I've enjoyed NBC's behind-the-scenes looks at using Gary Lineker's production company at Crystal Palace, West Brom, Watford more, because those are still more homespun, regional clubs, neighborhood clubs, if you will, clubs in the case of West Brom, in a city that neighbors Birmingham and has a strong fan base and has a historic club. So this will be a different perspective, because when you talk about Chelsea, Liverpool, Man City, you're talking about global brands, which is why Netflix and Amazon are interested in it. But it may not be as interesting to diehard football fans like us. To me, the standard is still the QPR four-year plan documentary.
Yeah.
That's the gold standard. I do a refresher course every 6 months and watch that documentary again, because it reminds me about some of the behind the scenes at a football club. And that's a pretty high standard. I'm not sure Man City, Chelsea, or Liverpool will ever give the kind of access to documentary filmmakers, because of the consciousness they have about their brand,
right,
to get that level of interest.
To me, it seems to be more of a promotional piece. I mean, and I'm sure the clubs are looking at this. I'm sure Liverpool looked at Being Liverpool as a promotional piece, mainly for the USA. How do we promote our club to a much bigger audience? Between Mondays and Fridays, when there's no matches on, how can we get our name out there and win new fans? And the QPR, example was a great one in terms of really what a documentary is all about, in terms of having getting in and finding out all the dirty details as well as the good details about how a club is run. Kartik, what about the last piece of news for this section?
Yeah, so this weekend we're going to have another one of those MLS NFL doubleheaders on Fox Sports over the air. Last year they had 1.3 million viewers, more or less, the most kind of most watched MLS telecast of any kind in 12 years. They're once again going to do a similar thing this year with a split national coverage. Those of you who have a 4:15, I believe it is, NFL kickoff will get the on Fox, on your local Fox affiliate, will get Sporting Kansas City versus the LA Galaxy from Children's Mercy Park, a U.S. Open champion. Kansas City against a struggling LA Galaxy team have lost both of their last two games 4-0, including 4-0 last night in Atlanta. Speaking of Atlanta, if you have a 1 o'clock NFL kickoff on your local Fox affiliate, you will get Atlanta United against Montreal at Mercedes-Benz Stadium. Big game, Montreal. Huge victory over Toronto that came out of nowhere at BMO. They're back in the playoff race. It looked like they had been written off for dead. So if they can win this game, Montreal, they're right back in the mix. That game would be a 5 p.m. kickoff on your local Fox affiliate. You're going to have to check your local listings wherever you are to know which game you're going to get.
Yeah, and also Landon Donovan's going to be making his MLS broadcast debut on Fox this weekend, Kartik, as part of one of those games.
I don't know which game he'll be on, though. I have to mention that.
But
do you, by any chance?
I do not. If you want to take a look in a second. But, I mean, to me, Kartik, I mean, this is just a way for MLS to juice the numbers. And essentially, I mean, you could have Halifax Town against Accrington Stanley and put that on a broadcast next to an NFL game this Sunday and get major numbers and report
right.
That even Accrington Stanley had over 1.2 million people watching this game. And when it's not really, it's all it is you're doing a doubleheader with an MLS NFL broadcast. And for all the bars and all the homes that have the NFL games on, they're just hoping that people just leave the TV sets on and not even pay attention
to that. Donovan will be working with John Strong on the Los Angeles-Kansas City game, which is, I think, a little bit unfortunate. I'd like to see him on the Atlanta game. That game will be Del Camera and Brad Friedel.
Yeah, so it's Atlanta would have been a better one, but yeah. Anyway, you can predict next week probably by Tuesday or Wednesday. Probably Wednesday, you'll have an MLS press release going out and a story on Twitter about MLS breaks records.
Look, I don't know if you remember. You probably remember this. Some of our listeners don't. There was a season where Fox decided to throw tape-delayed Premier League games that they had already shown live on Fox Soccer Channel at 11 a.m. on a Sunday on after NFL games, and they got even higher numbers than this. I mean, it was pretty I thought it was pretty absurd. There were games that if you had any interest in soccer at all, you probably already knew the results of. One was a Liverpool-Arsenal game. A Liverpool-Man United game, if I remember.
Well, Chelsea. It was Chelsea-Liverpool. And it still holds the record for the most watched Premier League match. I think it was 1.6 million. It was on a Sunday, tape delayed. I think it was around about this. Yeah, it would have been like January or February. But yeah, again, too, it's a number that I just don't pay much attention to because, yes, it's a massive number, no matter who's playing, if it's MLS or the Premier League in the past. But it's a fake number. It's just, to me, it's not a real number of the number of people that are actually wanting to go out of the way to watch the match. And we've seen this with the Bundesliga. The Bundesliga did this, I think, last year or the year before. They had a big number. They had like a 1.1 million number of viewers for a Bayern Munich game. It was tape delayed. And the following week, when Bayern Munich had their game on FS1, I think like a week later, it had 68,000 people watching it or something like that. It's just, to me, it's just a way for both Fox and MLS to say, hey, look at us. Aren't we great? And just to juice the numbers up, just make the numbers look a lot bigger than they actually are.
Yeah, I think that also another thing that's happened is that the shift of early season MLS games from ESPN2 to ESPN, which began last season. There are far more ESPN broadcasts than ESPN2 broadcasts. That bumps the numbers up slightly. But again, now we're seeing late in the season most of those games on ESPN2, so that offsets it a bit. But it's just interesting to look at the tricks that Fox and ESPN play to try and bump up that MLS bottom line number ever so slightly so they can say the ratings are improving each season.
Right.
When in reality, we know the television audience is stagnant.
Yeah, and as of last week, I think MLS numbers, TV numbers for this season are down about between 4 and 6%. So this will give them a bump, and this may move it up to, they're down 2% now after this big weekend or something like that. We'll have to wait and see. But anyway, that's just me trying to be at least realistic. In some ways, it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity for more mainstream fans to watch a soccer match and just come across it by accident. And hopefully they'll continue watching MLS games or Premier League or whatever it is in following weeks. But we've seen that this isn't the case. But anyway, let's move on, Kartik. TV ratings. We don't have all of the numbers in yet, but we do have a few. So I'll just go through a few of these. Of course, we'll have all of them later this week on worldsoccertalk.com. Spurs against Swansea was on NBC. That one had 621,000 people. Man United against Everton on NBCSN, that one had 534,000. Watford, Man City, they had 335,000.
Oh, let me, before I completely forget, let me mention a smart move by NBC, Irma related, for the previous week, which was to bring Andres Cantor up to Connecticut. I wasn't able to watch it because we were in the middle of Irma, but Andres Cantor was apparently in the NBC studios on the English language broadcast of one of the games, flying up from Miami and going to Connecticut. And that would have been a treat. I wish I had seen it, but we had already lost power by that time.
Yeah, me too. I think either that or I was traveling, but I missed it too. I did hear about it, but I was wondering why, but that makes total sense, Kartik. So Chelsea against Arsenal was on CNBC, that one had 328,000 viewers. The USA-New Zealand friendly, the first one, which was on last Friday on ESPN2, had 272,000. And then the final two was New York Red Bulls against Philadelphia on ESPN on Sunday, and that one had 259,000 viewers. And then last but not least, Southampton against Crystal Palace, 209,000 on NBCSN. Kartik, moving on to our listener mailbag. The first question or comment is from a listener, and he posted this on the website. This is in response to our last podcast where we talked about kind of criticizing the U.S. soccer media for being soft on the U.S. men's national team, especially after the poor performances of late. And it's from Silver Ray, and he says, I have yet to see a scathing article on how Bruce Arena is failing U.S. soccer on worldsoccertalk.com. Hold yourselves responsible, too. Which he raises a good point. And it's something, too, that we've been critical on this podcast about Bruce Arena. Oftentimes, we don't have time to go ahead, and the amount of time it takes to do the podcast, sometimes we don't have time to go ahead and write a subsequent article that talks about the same topic. But I think that's something we'll be taking a closer look at in the near future. And, of course, the U.S. hopefully will do well against Panama and in some of these games where we wouldn't have to write it. But we'll wait and see what happens. The next one is from Larry Kern. He posted this on worldsoccertalk.com. He says, the quality of play in the MLS is kind of pathetic. The more American players that decide to play for teams in this country, the worse our national team will become. Playing in Europe is the only way to strengthen the player to the point that he can positively have a positive effect on the national squad's performance. The level of play in MLS is about equal to quality in most Central American countries, which in turn allows a thriving fan base. There are many Central American immigrants in our country. As a result, MLS teams are generally competitive, but not superior to clubs in CONCACAF. Our national team performs at about the same level when playing CONCACAF teams. Being a feeder league, much like Brazil, Argentina, and others, has been a very lucrative venture over the years. Selling young players to top teams in Europe has allowed those countries to reap the benefits when these players come home to play for their respective national teams. MLS should be a stepping stone to greater things in Europe, not a place for a talented player to languish against mediocre competition. Any thoughts on that one, Kartik?
Yeah, a couple things. First off, I don't think the quality of play in MLS is pathetic. I think one thing is if you're comparing it to the level of play in Europe, travel is much more extensive and you're playing over the summer. So that affects quality and speed of play. But a lot of the other things Larry has said, I agree with. MLS should be a feeder league. I've said that for years. The goal should be to develop guys between the ages of 18 and 21 and 22 and sell them on. That should absolutely be the goal of the league. And I think it is in some regards. One thing that was mentioned last night was Alejandro Moreno saying Tata Martino, unlike most MLS managers, has said that about his young players at Atlanta United, the likes of Andrew Carrollton and others. Hey, I want to make this guy good enough to where I can sell him to a European club. Of course, that's a guy coming from the perspective of being an Argentine manager who also managed in Europe. So that may be a little bit different perspective, but that's the right perspective. You look at leagues like the Belgian League. The Belgian League right now, the standard of play has improved. And what's happened is those clubs have been able to sell their players at the ages of 21 or 22. The big clubs in Spain, England, Germany, France, Italy. And what's ended up happening is Belgium's national team has essentially eclipsed the Dutch national team. They're doing what the Dutch used to do. They've accepted their role as a feeder league within Europe, and they're doing that job. So I think the idea of Major League Soccer being a feeder league, I absolutely agree with. I don't think the quality of play is necessarily pathetic. Obviously, it could improve, but I think there's some mitigating factors that unless MLS shifts their calendar, which is something I've been an advocate for, but it seems like the pro-rellers and the MLS fanboys, for lack of a better term, both gang up on me when I mention that. But unless the MLS shifts its calendar, I don't think the quality of play is really going to improve that much, honestly. I think that has so much to do with the slowness and methodical nature of the game, that you're playing in the hottest months of the year in a region, North America, that generally is hotter than Europe during the summer anyway.
Raymond Orozco on Facebook posts, he says, you guys have a phenomenal show, and I agree on your points when it comes to the vocal U.S. soccer fan on social media and the reporters to report in U.S. soccer, but I think it says a lot about American sports mentality in general. If you look at NBA players or NHL players that play in international competition and underperform, if they're wearing the U.S. jersey, the talking heads, media criticism is light compared to if they were to underperform for their club teams or individual teams in their respective sport. Next up, Kartik, is Leonard, and he posted this on worldsoccertalk.com. He says, what do you guys think about the new CPL? Is it a threat for MLS or a welcome competition?
Oh, I'm real excited about the CPL. In fact, I would reference an article I wrote a few years ago for Plastic Pitch Magazine, a Canadian soccer magazine, probably about 3 years ago now, of advocating the launch of the CPL when it was first being talked about, and advocating it from an American perspective, saying, hey, I think it's important you guys in Canada have your own domestic institutions where you take care of the Canadian players. I have to admit, even though we had Edmonton and Ottawa, and NASL Ottawa is now in USL, Edmonton, Ottawa, and NASL at the time, and the three big Canadian teams in MLS, they are in U.S.-based leagues where U.S. priorities, both business-wise, player development-wise, and player development-wise, will always be the priority. You need to look after your own. You need to have your own league where you're looking after Canadian players and growing the Canadian game. I'm a big fan of the CPL. Is it a threat to MLS? I don't know. That remains to be answered. But I am very excited about the launch of the league, and I have to admit, when I wrote that article 3 years ago and subsequent things that happened after that, I was skeptical. I'm always skeptical of the CSA's ability to pull things off because they have such a spotty track record. But it looks like the new leadership of the Canadian Soccer Association is going to pull this off, and kudos to them. And there's going to be some very interesting investment groups, by the way. CFL money, perhaps FC Edmonton jumping, maybe Ottawa jumping from USL in a few years in this league. So it'll be a good watch. And Chris, that might be another league that we have here on American television that people are interested in.
I don't know about that. I mean, is it Canadian Premier League? Is that the acronym?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, I think we have a tough enough a job of trying to get Americans to watch MLS as far
right.
as rather than watch Canadian soccer.
I think we're so intertwined. This is a great question about the television, because we're so intertwined culturally, and maybe you come from a different perspective and a more realistic perspective than me. I've worked in the game in this country, and I feel like having worked in the game, we have two national teams, the United States and Canada. I don't think of the U.S. as preeminent over Canada, just because the leagues I've worked in have had Canadian teams, Canadian players, and have thought of them as domestic players, even if at times they didn't count as domestic players under the roster rules. That maybe it's because I've worked in the game, I'll be interested in seeing how ex-Canadian player does on the Hamilton team or the Saskatchewan team in the CPL. But you might be right. The larger American audience probably won't care.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it's one of those things that, yes, there are some people, some Americans that are interested in seeing how the Canadians do, but for the most part, they're not paying attention. And if anything, they're paying attention more to Mexico than they are to Canada, and sometimes more than the United States in some ways. Okay, Kartik, next up is Oliver Say, and he posted this on worldsoccertalk.com. He says, the Fox Sports-produced UEFA Champions League broadcast of Celtic against PSG, which is on Facebook Live, is by far the worst English-language UEFA Champions League broadcast in the US for the past 25 years. I am sure that Christopher Harris will skewer the trio of Stuart Holden, attempting to do play-by-play, Mario Melchiot as analyst, and Rachel Bonetta as host. Stuart Holden needs to call his buddy John Strong for a play-by-play clinic before he attempts play-by-play again. At least he was trying and he was approaching the assignment as a professional. Melchiot was clowning around. He was unprofessional. Rachel Bonetta needs to do a lot of learning on the job, and quickly, her first mistake was referring to the UEFA Champions League anthem as the national anthems. Things went downhill from there. I will say that I did not see this one. Reason being, I think Hurricane Irma. I think either I had no power or I was preparing for the hurricane that was coming. I did go back and watch a few minutes of this one to kind of get a gist of what Oliver was saying and to see if I concurred. And for the most part, yeah, it's. I mean, I'm sure from Fox Sports' perspective, they probably told the trio of them, okay, like, hey, this is Facebook Live. Let's be relaxed and let's be conversational and let's have fun. Let's just go ahead and broadcast this one and have a lot of fun. And Stuart Holden's definitely not a commentator. Mario Melchiot probably went a bit too far. And then Rachel Bonetta was probably on this one, maybe in over her head on this one. But they also had the Man City Feyenoord game. Kartik, you probably missed that. That was on Facebook Live,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I saw the first 20 minutes of it and then got back to working in the yard. I was streaming it without power. I was streaming it with a phone line without power. So how would I describe it? Off of LTE, right? Not off of Wi-Fi. And so once it became 3-0, I turned it off. I didn't think Rachel Bonetta was awful. I did think Melchiot was bad and Holden seemed awkward. So, but I pretty much concur with what Oliver said. Maybe Bonetta had done a crash course the previous night after the disaster of Celtic versus PSG. But the other two were off their games, clearly. And I think with Stuart Holden, we've talked about this before. He is okay, but he's good when he's with John Strong. And that's, again, a commentator bringing the best out of his co-commentator.
All right. Two more questions from our listeners. The next one up is Clinton Cam through email. And he says, I've been recently noticing the debate among many MLS fans regarding whether to have a promotion relegation system for the league. I want to ask a couple of questions comparing the MLS to other leagues. The Australian A-League has no promotion relegation, and they currently are planning to expand across Australia with potentially having up to 8 teams, including another team in New Zealand. What are some of the differences between the two leagues respectively, and can the MLS emulate some of the ideas of what the A-League is doing in order to be a successful league? Given that we have heard Kartik's explanations on the problems with promotion relegation in MLS, what is the difference between MLS and the China Super League? How can China do well with promotion relegation in the first season while MLS cannot have promotion relegation and they've been around for 22 years? Given they are large countries with cities having up to 3 teams, such as in Shanghai, thank you for reading my email and keep up the good work.
Yeah, a lot of American investors are risk averse. It's really kind of one of the the bottom lines when it comes to talking about Pharrell. Yeah, I agree with Clinton. I mean, it could be implemented the way it's been forced on Australia. They didn't necessarily go along willingly to doing Pharrell, a lot of the leadership of the soccer community in that country. I think we should have promotion and relegation. It's just a matter of how you cut through the clutter, and you have American owners who are risk averse, and if they're exposed to the open market and an open league system, as we've seen in England. Look, I you know, people get on me when I say this, and people think that I'm just being an anti-nationalist or whatever. But if you're a fan of a club in England, you do not want an American buying your club. Sorry, Chris. I mean, with Swansea, you don't. And they seem risk averse. They seem not able to compete in a marketplace where there aren't certain protections and certain entitlements they get. That's just American investors in general when it comes to sports. So I think that's really the bottom line. The problem with implementing Pharrell here is that too many of the high-level investors don't want that sort of thing. And they've shown when they invest in the sport abroad that they generally fail.
Yeah, it's I mean, for me as a Swansea City supporter, someone who was born in Wales, someone that's lived in the United States for 33, 34 years now, having the American investors come in, actually, I think I'm more on the positive side in terms of this, how it's gone so far. But they're looking at trying to invest and expand the stadium and actually take over actually buy the stadium. They don't own it, so get the stadium rights and make it make the club more commercially generating more revenue commercially worldwide. So for me, I mean, it's just one outlier, but one club. But for Swansea, it could end up being a positive where you have a foreign investor coming in, no matter where they're from, America, you know, the Middle East, China, wherever, investing money into the club and then hopefully expanding the stadium. And it's probably something that maybe Swansea as a club before might have had a tough time trying to do by themselves. So we'll have to wait and see. But yeah, I see the negatives too from the foreign ownership perspective. Whether they're American or whoever they are, it's just definitely had some issues there. Lastly, Kartik, Mark Ozinski sent this one in through email. He says, I enjoy your podcast and hope you might discuss the question on a subsequent episode. We often hear that the US does not have the best soccer talent and players will go to Europe to play against better talent to gain experience. Regarding Christian Pulisic playing in Germany, first, why does Germany, who arguably have better players already, want to bring over an American at a very young age to help make him better? Does that not take a spot away from a homegrown player? Second, does the fact that Pulisic is playing and scoring goals over there mean that he is already that he is a top player compared to the German talent, or is he actually quite average compared to German talent? How does this impact both countries' national team aspirations? That is, Pulisic building his skills in Germany, I guess, and how it might ultimately play against your country nationally, I guess, if Germany played the United States, perhaps. And then related question is, where does Pulisic stack up compared to a Jordan Morris, who's instead playing in MLS, and why is Jordan Morris not over in Europe too? I appreciate your response on a complex question.
I'll take that. First off, I don't think the Germans care. Look, we had this conversation, you and I, in Dusseldorf with some Bundesliga officials. It's the United States. They kind of were mocking the United States, the obsession with the national team of the United States. When you are in a footballing culture, your primary goal, if you are a club side like Borussia Dortmund, is to develop talent for Borussia Dortmund. Or if you're a club side like Hoffenheim, to develop talent that you can then sell to Bayern Munich or Borussia Dortmund or to Liverpool or Manchester City or whoever. That is your primary focus, not whether this guy will be good for the German national team or if you're a Belgian side for the Belgian national team, etc. Club football. That's the culture. That's who develop players in these countries. Mm-hmm. I don't think Germany cares that they're developing an American player who might come back and haunt Germany. Now, it was a little ironic, though. There was a game here in Florida in Jacksonville in 1999 where Germany played the United States, and the United States won, and they scored three goals, and all three goals were scored by guys who were in the Bundesliga. And in the case of Jovan Karofsky, who I think had one of the goals, had been there a while. So that, there is the, those ironies in international football. Look at the U.S. this past month, right? Every goal against the United States was scored by someone in Major League Soccer. Who you could argue at that oh gosh, MLS is helping the rest of CONCACAF more than the United States, and I think at this point it is. The point is, I just don't think people care. Now, on the clubs care. They're looking to develop talent for themselves. Mm-hmm. On the Jordan Morris question, he made a decision. First of all, he played college soccer, so he's on a completely different trajectory than Pulisic. He made a decision to sign with the Seattle Sounders when he had an offer from Werder Bremen. Now, speaking of Werder Bremen, we have another big American prospect, Joshua Sargent, from St. Louis. You and I were talking to Taylor Twellman about him 2 months ago when Twellman was here in Fort Lauderdale for the El Clasico match. And Twellman indicated to us he thought that Sargent was going to sign in Europe and not in MLS, if you remember when we were talking to him. And right. Sure enough, Werder Bremen put out a press release, which I think was lost in all the talk of NASL lawsuit versus the USSF, put out a press release on Wednesday saying that they've agreed to sign Sargent. He's still 17. He doesn't turn 18 until next year. But they have agreed to sign him, and he will come to Germany on his 18th birthday and will play with the youth side, and then next season will be integrated into the first team squad. So I think that there are guys now that, if they're able to go to Europe at the age of 17 or 18, they go. There are other players. We have a couple guys who've come through MLS academies. I mentioned Andrew Carrollton at Atlanta, a guy that they might sell on. Eric Palmer Brown, another guy, has come through Sporting Kansas City's academy. I think maybe he stagnated being in MLS. He has signed a pre-contract with Manchester City. He's not going to play for the first team at Man City yet, but different strokes for different folks. I think it's now becoming a case where it depends on your own comfort level. A lot of guys are comfortable just staying in the United States and developing, and hopefully if they do that, they get games, because it is more difficult to break in Germany. Real quickly, I know this is a long answer, but it was a long question. We have several guys in Germany that you may not know about. Weston McKennie is a guy that just started for Schalke the other day in the Bundesliga. He's an 18-year-old. We have Haji Wright over there. We have Nick Tadaguay over there. We have a number of young American players who have gone to Germany who have been under the radar. And they've gone after Pulisic went. So I think the general trend is, if you're a better U.S. player, and obviously I'm mentioning Joshua Sargent too, if you're a better U.S. player, you go to Germany. If you're not in that top tier, you're going to sign with an MLS development academy, or even a development academy and connected to a pro club in USL or NASL.
And it's not just about playing time, though, too, Kartik. I think it's also about the coaching level, the training that they're getting.
Yeah. In Germany, it's much, much higher.
So it makes sense. And actually, at the end of the day, it will help out the U.S. national team, but not directly. And in answer to the question from before, too, I concur in terms of from Mark, is that it's based on the club side, but it can help the national team on the U.S. national side, but that's not what they're thinking. They're thinking on a club-specific basis. How does this impact Dortmund or Bremen or whichever the team is? Now, for listeners, if you do have any questions or feedback or want to agree or disagree with anything we've said on the show, feel free to contact us. We'd be more than happy to read out your questions on air. You can reach us through email, which is web@worldsoccertalk.com. It's through Twitter at WSoccerTalk, and then Facebook is facebook.com/worldsoccertalk, or through our website, worldsoccertalk.com, in the comments section. And Kartik, moving on to our feature topic of the week, and this is one that you and I kind of traded some emails back and forth earlier this week. We were kind of discussing some story ideas, and I had one story idea, which is talking about how soccer is no longer a niche sport, and it's a lot of people say soccer is just a very niche sport in the United States. And every time I hear that, it just rubs me the wrong way. I completely disagree with that. But I think from your perspective, I think you agreed with it. So
yes.
We were going back and forth. We didn't get a chance to discuss it, so we thought we'd discuss it here. But I'll let you go first in terms of your thoughts on this one, and then I'll step in a little bit.
Yeah, and I have an article that will be up at World Soccer Talk fairly soon regarding my point of view. I think there's a difference between being an underground sport, which soccer was in this country 10 years ago, to being a niche sport, and then being a mainstream sport. I think there's three things on the ladder. I would say mainstream sports year-round are really just football, baseball, basketball. That's it. Maybe golf, maybe NASCAR racing, maybe. Golf, there tends to be spikes around the majors and also the major tournaments, the four major tournaments, championships, and the World Golf Championship events. So, and NASCAR, we've seen their numbers come down fairly steadily the last several years, and it's now kind of falling toward a niche level. So maybe it's we think of these things differently. I just don't think, and I have a lot that I've written down, and as I said, there'll be an article on this on World Soccer Talk soon. I don't think that there is enough of a sustained interest in soccer in this country year-round to make it a mainstream sport yet. Now, we've gone from being underground to being niche, which is a big jump. But when you look at these television ratings, and we go through them every week, if it's not a massive international tournament, you don't see numbers clearing 2 million. Even the Champions League final, even with the Real Madrid-Barca El Clasico game in Miami, with all the buildup ESPN had, you don't have games clearing 2.5 million regularly. You don't have that for Premier League games. You mentioned it earlier that the highest rated Premier League game still to this day is a tape delayed game that was shown on Fox 5 or 6 years ago. Now there's much more interest in the Premier League now, thanks to NBC, than there was when ESPN and Fox were showing it, but it seems to have tailed off. And I think NBC's acknowledged that in the way they've marketed the Premier League. It's similar to hockey for them. I would consider the NHL a niche, other than during the Stanley Cup playoffs. College basketball is a niche, except during the NCAA tournament, and soccer is a niche, except during the Copa America or World Cup. I think it's pretty simple, and we can get a little deeper into this.
Yeah, so from my perspective, what I look at is looking at, say, an average week of soccer in the United States. So we did a podcast a few weeks ago where we're talking about the sheer number of games that MLS is competing against. And it's not even MLS, it's Premier League, it's Liga MX, it's all of them. But on that particular weekend that we were looking at, there was 155 soccer games available to viewers in the United States. Many of them were on streaming, but also a bunch of them were on television. Now, you look at other sports, so you look at NFL football, you look at NBA basketball, you look at Major League Baseball, and count the number of games that are going on a typical weekend. Soccer is so much bigger in terms of more of a global world sport that if you took those 155 games and then combined all of the viewing numbers for those matches, it's not a niche sport. It's a big sport in the United States. You mean it's not your NFL football, but those numbers, which at one point in the future are going to have to calculate and see what those numbers are, but they're going to be some pretty impressive numbers. The challenge that soccer has is it is so fractured in terms of so many options to watch. Whether you're watching Premier League, Liga MX, MLS, and then you go down the list. League One, La Liga. There's so many leagues to watch that those numbers look small when you look at it on a single basis for each of those matches. But again, when you combine those are some impressive numbers. The one thing I will say about NFL football, or the NFL, is that it's so big in the United States that it makes every other sport look small. So, in many ways, I think that NFL is bigger in the United States than soccer is in the UK or Great Britain, because America is such a massive country, such a much, much bigger population, a lot more channels kind of broadcasting, your ESPNs and FS1s. All day long, it's all NFL or college football versus the UK, which is a lot smaller country, that NFL football is bigger than say, the Premier League in the United Kingdom only. But the thing with the United States is if you take away NFL football and you say, okay, all right, let's take football out of this conversation and then look at what's left. So you look at basketball, baseball, soccer, NHL. I think in that conversation, I think soccer is actually is pretty competitive in terms of in that discussion of talking about which sports is one of the biggest. It's just that the NFL kind of dwarfs everything else and makes soccer look small when actually, in fact, it isn't. I just want to throw out a few stats, Kartik, but soccer is the second most popular sport in the U.S. among Americans aged 12 to 24. So that's huge in terms of the growth of soccer as they get older. Soccer fans are 20% more likely than the average American to have household incomes over $100,000. And they're 31% more likely to have children under 17 at home. So not only are they 20% more likely to be more affluent, but also they have a lot of children. So that has a big impact in terms of, again, growing the sport of soccer even more so in the U.S. Among Hispanic Americans aged 12 to 24, soccer is the number one sport. And last but not least, the sport of soccer is increasingly popular among Americans aged 6 to 17. 11% of the TV audience who watch Premier League soccer on NBC, SN are kids from 6 to 17, compared to only 4.6% of World Series audience, 9.4% of NBA conference finals, and 9% of NHL conference finals. So you've got a ton of kids, teens, young adults watching soccer, living up and growing with the sport. And to me, when you look at it, I mean, to me, it's not a niche sport. It's one of the major sports in the U.S. It's just that the NFL makes it look small.
I think you're looking at a situation where we have to hope that those people stay with soccer. I've seen interest in soccer in the past when it was more of an underground sport, admittedly, and didn't have the sort of exposure. Interest in soccer before among kids who were in youth soccer or in college because it was a cool thing in college and they met folks, international folks who were Liverpool fans or whatever at their universities. And then they get back, get into the job market, and it's football, or a Miami Heat or whatever, baseball, New York Yankees. So that, and I mentioned this in the article I'm writing, that's a big part of it, is making sure the current generation that is playing youth soccer, that loves the sport and loves the participatory side of the sport, and is walking around shopping malls with Liverpool and Real Madrid shirts on, stays with the sport. And if they do, I think it mainstreams it. But they're 12 to 24 now, as you mentioned. When they're in that 35 to 44 year old age bracket and they're still with soccer, then we're mainstream. And we're close, right? I mean, we'll know in the next 5 to 7 years if they stick with it. But I actually agree with your point on that, and that's part of my point, is I've seen the drop-off in the past of people who are soccer fans, and then they get intoxicated by the college football culture or the NFL culture, and they'll say, oh, yeah, I'm a Chelsea fan, but they're not really paying attention to Chelsea anymore. I'm hoping that the availability – and again, a lot of that, I should mention, happened when the Premier League was on – Fox Soccer Channel, a channel most people didn't get, and the NBA, and there wasn't the kind of availability of internet streams, legal internet streams that there are now, and La Liga was on Gold TV, and et cetera, and you couldn't see soccer as readily as you can. I think that's a thing, and then also Atlanta United. It's one city. Right, it's one club, but it's the first time we've seen MLS really make it in a big way in a major, major market. And that there's kind of a mainstreaming of soccer in Atlanta, a notoriously fickle sports town, by the way. A sports town which notoriously doesn't support even winning baseball and basketball teams. I mean, a town where when the Braves were winning the NL East every year, they had half empty stadiums, and a city where Georgia Tech football and Georgia Tech basketball would be competing at a high level in the ACC, and there would be limited interest. And you know, just that's why there was a lot of question marks about MLS in that city, but it seems to have really worked. And so that might be what you're talking about, Chris. There might be a lot of 12 to 24 year olds in Atlanta saying, this is my team. I'm more into this than the Atlanta Falcons or the Atlanta Hawks. Or it's also a town that's lost an NHL team twice, and NHL teams don't relocate often. So that's the kind of bad sports market it is. So to me, that's a very healthy sign, but I'm not ready yet to say all of these things we're talking about are definitive in that it's a mainstream sport.
One of the biggest factors, I think, is accessibility. So we talk about a lot of these kids who are getting into soccer. It's their favorite sport or second favorite sport. And they're between the ages of 12 and 24 or say 12 and 27, say, perhaps. The issue I have is accessibility. So if they're growing up and they're wearing Messi shirts or Ronaldo shirts and they're loving La Liga and they're loving the sport of soccer, still to this day, La Liga is not as accessible as it should be. It should be some of these games, especially the big games, should be on your ABCs or CBSs of the world, or NBC, Foxes, etc. Instead, it's on beIN Sports, and there's nothing wrong with beIN Sports, but it's not as accessible. And that's part of the reason, I think, in many ways, that NFL is so popular, and that the NBA is that you can be switching on Fox, your local Fox station, and be watching these games. You don't have to try to get a diagram to figure out, okay, now how do I get beIN Sports? And, okay, all right, it's not available, or FS2, it's not available in my area, but then I have to get a subscription to a streaming service, and I have to get a Chromecast to be able to stream it to my TV set. It's just too complicated, too many steps for a lot of people. So making it as accessible and as easy as possible to watch the sport is going to help on a continuous basis. And I don't mean just, an MLS game as a doubleheader of an NFL game this weekend, and then you don't see it again on there for another year. I'm talking about on a regular basis. So it's going to take time. I still think it just still rubs me the wrong way when people say it's a very niche sport. I disagree with that still. But there's still a long way to go for it to grow. But I still think it's established as a major sport in the United States and will continue to do so. Now, Kartik, where can listeners find you on the internet if you have any new articles or to stay on top of the latest Kartik happenings?
Yeah, there'll be. You can find me on Twitter at KKFLA737, here at WorldSoccerTalk.com, over at TheFloridaSqueeze.com, and various places. I'll be on SiriusXM tonight, if you're listening to this Thursday, discussing the NASL lawsuit with our friend Brian Dunseth and Tony Miola, our friends. Just various places this last week because of the NASL situation. So I'm popping up in some different places.
Excellent. Well, thanks for listening. You can get a new episode of the World Soccer Talk podcast every Thursday. Every episode is released on SoundCloud, YouTube, Stitcher, iTunes, Audio Boom, and WorldSoccerTalk.com. If you like the show, share it with your friends on social media and give us a review. And Kartik, what should they do?
Enjoy your football.